The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter. Our first article tells us about four questions to ask before you get anesthesia. Find out about the kind of anesthetic medication you need and its potential risks. Anesthesia is a gift of modern medicine. It is used in hundreds of types of procedures. It is not just reserved for surgery. The drugs that keep you from feeling pain are also administered for routine treatments, like removal of a mole or a skin tag, and screening tests, like colonoscopy. Yet anesthesia's common use is hardly casual. We must always consider safety, especially for older patients and underlying conditions, said Dr. Satya Krishna Ramachandran, an anesthesiologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital. Here are important questions to ask when the doctor says you need any type of anesthesia medication. Number one, what kind of anesthesia will I get and what will it do? There are four main types of anesthesia. Number one is local anesthesia. This numbs a small area of the body and blocks pain at its source. A quote-unquote local is given by injection and used for minor surgeries and procedures such as skin cancer removal. Then there's regional anesthesia. This numbs an entire section of the body, such as an arm or leg, or everything below the chest. It's given by injection, or a small tube, catheter, to a cluster of nerves. The anesthetic stops pain signals from reaching the brain. You may be awake or sedated during the procedure. Regional anesthesia is often used for abdominal surgery or cesarean section for childbirth. Then there's monitored anesthesia or intravenous IV sedation. This induces a relaxed and pain-free state. Medications are given directly into a vein to make you drowsy. This is commonly used for colonoscopies. Lastly, there's general anesthesia. This temporarily blocks the ability of the brain to feel pain and causes you to lose consciousness. You receive a combination of drugs by IV or by inhaling them through a mask, and then an anesthesiologist continually checks your bodily functions throughout the surgery. The second question you should ask is, what are the risks of this anesthetic? While anesthetics are generally considered safe, they have potential side effects. A local anesthetic might cause pain or itching at the injection site. The other anesthetics, regional, monitored, and general anesthesia, might cause an hour of shivering as the anesthetic wears off, or a few hours of nausea, grogginess, headache, or a drop in blood pressure that can cause fainting. Other more serious physical complications are extremely rare. People who are ages 65 and older who get regional, monitored, or general anesthesia frequently experience temporary disorientation, known as delirium, and may also develop impaired thinking after surgery. It's unclear why surgery with anesthesia is tied to cognitive symptoms. Doctors theorize it might be due to existing vascular, meaning blood vessel, disease, previously undiagnosed cognitive decline, or brain inflammation caused by the body's stress response to surgery. In older patients, the brain takes longer to recover from the stress, Dr. Ramachandran said. But there is no evidence that anesthesia itself causes cognitive decline. The third question you might ask, can you reduce my delirium risk? If you're concerned about post-surgical delirium or impaired thinking, request a risk evaluation well in advance. Certain factors boost the chance of delirium, such as cardiovascular problems, cognitive decline, or the use of a lot of medications, poor sleep, malnutrition, or past episodes of delirium after surgery. If you have multiple conditions, we have to plan for that. We might use different medications, consult with a specialist for potential preoperative changes in medical care, or schedule reorientation therapy, Dr. Ramachandran says. Reorientation therapy involves special nursing care after surgery that continually helps to orient you and get you up and moving. During a procedure, your team might also use a new addition to anesthesia care that's called processed EEG monitoring. It displays the effect of the anesthetic on brain waves, which helps anesthesiologists determine if the dose should be adjusted, Dr. Ramachandran says. You can also ask if the risks of anesthesia and surgery outweigh the benefits of a procedure, or if a local anesthetic or numbing cream can be used for small procedure rather than stronger types of anesthetics. Lastly, you might ask, how else should I prepare? You don't need to prepare for local anesthesia. For regional, monitored, or general anesthesia, you'll have to fast for 6 to 8 hours before a procedure. You might also need to stop taking certain medications days in advance. Ask your doctor for instructions that are based on your specific circumstances. In addition, if you've experienced anesthesia side effects in the past, such as nausea, especially if you have motion sickness, ask if your anesthesiologist can give you a medication to ease the symptom. That discussion can take place shortly after you arrive at a surgical center. Unlike anesthesia 50 years ago, today we know how to make it more predictable, Dr. Ramachandran says. The majority of patients recover just fine, but it's still important to take every precaution. And this next article is about a new approach to peripheral artery disease. GLP-1 medications are being studied as a way to ease symptoms of this common and debilitating condition. Walking can be excruciating for people with peripheral artery disease, known as PAD, in the legs. The condition reduces the amount of blood that reaches leg muscles, making even a short trip to the mailbox painful and challenging. Doctors have had few ways to relieve symptoms, but new evidence suggests that GLP-1 receptor agonists, the blockbuster drugs that treat diabetes and obesity, might help. This is something we're watching very closely. It's unclear if the medications are actually treating PAD or if they're controlling underlying conditions, said Dr. Nicolaus Zacharias, a vascular surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Just like arteries of the heart, the walls of arteries elsewhere in the body, typically in the legs, but also in the arms or abdomen, can become stuffed with fatty deposits and plaque, a condition called atherosclerosis. The narrowed arteries leave little room for blood flow, shortchanging the muscles of oxygen and nutrients they need. This leads to claudication, a painful impairment that occurs with activity and gets better with rest. If you have PAD, there's also a good chance you have atherosclerosis in your heart and brain arteries, increasing your risk for heart attack or stroke. PAD raises risk for skin ulcers, gangrene, and limb amputation, too. Doctors diagnose PAD with a physical exam, a test called an ankle brachial index, that compares blood pressure in your arms and legs, and sometimes an ultrasound exam to see if a specific artery is blocked. The main way to treat PAD is with a walking program supervised by a physical therapist. The exercise helps reroute blood flow around blocked arteries. That, in combination with smoking cessation and controlling diabetes, cholesterol, and high blood pressure, often leads to results within 6 months. If not, we might need to do a procedure that improves blood flow, Dr. Zacharias said. What about medication? Only a few drugs are approved to increase blood flow to the legs, and just one, cilostazol, is a top choice recommended by guidelines. Unfortunately, the medication doesn't work for everyone. One out of two people who take cilostazol feels improvement. But it doesn't treat the cause. It has a lot of side effects, and it's not successful for people with heart failure, Dr. Zacharias says. So the idea that GLP-1s might ease PAD symptoms is encouraging. Most recently, a randomized controlled trial published May 3, 2025 in The Lancet found that a GLP-1 boosted walking ability and quality of life in people with PAD and diabetes. The study involved about 800 people with an average age of 68 with diabetes, PAD, and mild pain. About half of them were directed to take 1 milligram per week of the GLP-1 drug semaglutide, and the other half took a fake medication or placebo. After 1 year, people in the GLP-1 group could walk 13% further, had more pain-free walking, had lower blood sugar, and lost more weight than the people in the placebo group. It could be that at the same time the medication is decreasing inflammation in the body, it might also be reducing plaque in the blood vessel wall, Dr. Zacharias said. We just don't know yet. If you have PAD, you might be wondering if it's time to ask your doctor about taking a GLP-1 drug. Dr. Zacharias says it might be appropriate in certain instances. The indications for prescribing GLP-1s are for diabetes, obesity, some cases of heart disease, or some cases of sleep apnea, not an isolated case of PAD. However, if a patient with PAD also has diabetes or obesity, then yes, I might prescribe a GLP-1. I already have in selective cases, he notes. That careful approach will likely remain standard until there's much more evidence that GLP-1s help people with PAD. GLP-1s have side effects, especially gastrointestinal problems, Dr. Zacharias said. We want to improve your lifestyle so that, for example, you can make it to the mailbox without leg pain. But we may not know for years if GLP-1s are a safe and effective treatment for PAD. Our third article asks, is there finally a way to measure tinnitus? By the way, you may have also heard this referenced as tinnitus. Both pronunciations are correct. However, most medical professionals will use tinnitus. Harvard scientists say they've discovered a novel way to assess this distressing, mysterious condition. When someone has tinnitus, a phantom ringing, whooshing, or buzzing sound in the ear, doctors usually have to take the person's word for it. While fancy tests can show if the brain's hearing sensors are in high gear, a potential sign of tinnitus, there's no way to detect the actual sound or intensity of the disorder. That might be changing. Harvard researchers recently identified biomarkers that appear to capture tinnitus severity for the first time. Scientists recruited about 100 healthy people, ages 19 to 60, to take part in a unique tinnitus study. None of the participants had hearing loss, but about half said they had severe tinnitus or mild sound sensitivity. hyperacusis. All participants underwent brain activity scans and filled out questionnaires on their general health and their tinnitus. They took part in something new. The researchers videotaped participants' faces while they listened to pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant sounds. In particular, the researchers tracked subtle facial movements and dilation of the pupils. We wanted to think about other brain regions that get input from sound and turn to the ones that regulate stress, says Dr. Polly, the study's senior author and director of the Lauer Tinnitus Research Center at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. So what were the results? People who didn't have tinnitus had measurably different facial responses and pupil dilation only in response to unpleasant sounds. In contrast, all sounds caused people with severe tinnitus or hyperacusis to have few facial movements, a blunted effect characteristic of tinnitus, and over-dilated pupils. Their sympathetic nervous systems were always in overdrive. Even harmless sounds were treated as possible threats, Polly said. The findings, when fed to a computer model, accurately predicted the severity of symptoms participants had reported on questionnaires. If the findings are replicated in additional studies, it could mean that doctors might finally have an objective way to measure tinnitus severity. This could be useful in many ways, such as gauging whether tinnitus has gotten louder or softer and whether treatment is working. One thing I really like is that the biomarkers can be detected without incredibly expensive or invasive tests, Polly says. Ultimately, we want to develop an open access, video-based platform so other groups can use these measurements. But what can you do? No matter how tinnitus is detected, ways to treat it are still limited. The following strategies might help. One is to make tinnitus less annoying. You might be able to redirect negative thoughts and emotions about tinnitus with hypnosis, mindfulness, or cognitive behavioral therapy. Such approaches are targeted at making the stress of tinnitus less important, so you're better at coping with it, Polly said. There's sound therapy. For some, but not all, people with tinnitus, masking the sounds might distract overactive brain cells. Sounds might come from a bedside sound machine or a wearable device. Three, a strategy is to manage stress. Any type of meditation, such as mindfulness, yoga, or gardening, helps tamp down the body's stress response and trigger the opposite effect, called the relaxation response. A well-studied phenomenon that reduces stress hormones and, in turn, helps lower your heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing rate. Four, you might see your doctor. If you've self-diagnosed your tinnitus, it's important to see your primary care provider or an ear, nose, and throat doctor known as an otolaryngologist. Tinnitus is thought to be caused by hearing loss and damage to auditory nerve fibers, even if you have normal hearing. But in some cases, tinnitus is caused by a cyst in the ear or a buildup of earwax. Treating these conditions can eliminate the phantom sound. And finally, you might join an online support group. Look for tinnitus groups on social media or through the American Tinnitus Association, the ATA.org. site. You might pick up tips that work for other people or at least feel empowered by camaraderie. Now, we're asked to take a look at what's involved with hand therapy. Specialized therapists can help you regain the use of your hands so you can return to the activities that matter most to you. Sometimes aching or injured hands need more than rest, medication, or home remedies to function or recover. In that case, your doctor might recommend that you work with a certified hand specialist, or a CHT. If so, be prepared for comprehensive therapy that extends beyond your hand. What is a certified hand therapist? A CHT is an expert in rehabilitating the hand and entire arm. We traditionally work from the shoulder to the elbow, wrist, and hand because you can't treat one part of the limb without it affecting the function of another, says Betty Hearn, a CHT at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. The specialty combines some approaches from both physical therapy, PT, which focuses on strength and physical function, and occupational therapy, or OT, which focuses on modifying activities that have become challenging. CHTs must pass a rigorous exam before earning their certification. They can't even take the test unless they are licensed OTs or PTs with at least 3 years of experience and 4,000 hours of direct practice experience with hand and upper extremity rehabilitation. So who are the candidates for hand therapy? People seek hand therapy for any number of conditions. For instance, an underlying condition such as arthritis, a hand injury of any kind, an injury of the shoulder, elbow, or wrist. Putrin's contracture, which is tissue growth that pulls the fingers toward the palm, carpal tunnel syndrome, swollen tissue that presses on a forearm nerve, causing tingling and numbness in the thumb and certain fingers. You might have a few problems at once, such as shoulder, wrist, and hand injuries from a fall. So what happens in therapy? A course of hand therapy typically lasts for 6 weeks, but could be longer or shorter depending on your needs. It involves many components. First, there's an evaluation. The CHT will assess your pain, wound if you have one, sensation, dexterity, ability to function, strength, and range of motion. I'll ask if you can open your fingers wide and make a fist, and if you have pain or swelling. We'll talk about what you want to do, what your goals are, and what we can do to meet your goals, Hearn said. Next, there's a tailored exercise program. We start with painless, gentle exercises that could get progressively more challenging, Hearn said. That could be routine strengthening exercises, such as squeezing a ball so muscles contract against resistance, or letting the shoulder dangle at your side and doing very small, relaxed circles. It just depends on the problem. There are also functional exercises. The CHT will help you tackle and modify activities that have become difficult, such as gripping a toothbrush, carrying bags, or buttoning a shirt. There will likely be homework. The CHT will encourage you to do certain exercises at home. For example, for arthritis, you might wring out a washcloth in warm water a couple of times a day. The warmth makes tissues feel looser, which helps relieve pain. And the wrist motion helps pump out swelling, Hearn said. We'll also recommend that you use your hands for as many routine activities as possible. Other aspects of therapy include CHTs do more than guide you through exercises. They can also do the following. They can make splints. CHTs can make a custom splint out of malleable thermoplastic material that holds your fingers in place so they don't hurt or allows you to get out of a cast safely while you do an exercise. Managing swelling. We may issue a compression garment like a sleeve or glove or show someone how to do edema mobilization, a specialized massage technique that reduces swelling, Hearn said. We work on managing pain. CHTs can teach you how to relieve pain using topical medications deep breathing exercises, and meditation. They can also guide you to adaptive equipment that makes it easier to grip or use tools. And they can offer emotional support. Many people are distraught about their impairment, and a large part of what we do is help them get through hard times. We use cognitive behavioral therapy to reduce or redirect negative thoughts. We also show them how they're getting better by having them do certain exercises like opening a jar. It gives them a boost and helps them overcome fear of moving their healing hand and arm, Hearn says. So, where do you find CHT? Your doctor can refer you to a CHT, or you can find a therapist in your area at the Hand Therapy Certification Commission website, www.htc.org/find-a-CHT. What if you don't have a CHT in your area? Hearn says there's nothing wrong with going to a regular occupational therapist, but if you want someone with specialized training, it's best to work with a CHT. CHT and OT are covered by insurance, including Medicare, if they're medically necessary. She says don't wait to seek help. Try to work with a therapist sooner rather than later. The hand tends to scar as it heals, which makes tissue stick together. And if you stop using your hand for 6 weeks, it takes real effort to retrain the brain to use it. So we start people on therapy before they're fully healed, Hearn says. Initiating gentle, controlled movement early after an injury prevents complications down the road and yields effective results. Within 6 weeks, most people have 80% of their normal function back, Hearn says, and they're doing more activities again, working, playing, golf, cooking, more, and feeling better about their ability to function. We have time for one quick article about walking pace being linked to reduced risks for a regular heartbeat. Brisk walking is a great form of aerobic exercise that works your heart and lungs. Now the exercise is tied to lower risks for an irregular heartbeat, arrhythmia, according to evidence published online April 15, 2025 by the journal Heart. Scientists evaluated the self-reported exercise and walking speed data of more than 420,000 men and women in an average age of 55 who were followed for 13 years. Compared with people who said they walked at a slow pace, less than 3 miles per hour, those who walked at an average pace or brisk pace had up to 30% lower risk for developing arrhythmia. That's all for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.